It is Monday, December 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, British Prime Minister Theresa May postpones a crucial House of Commons vote on Brexit. A Chinese telecommunications executive is due in a Canadian court for a bail hearing. And we hear why editorial cartoons are an effective form of cultural and political expression. It's all ahead. The European Court of Justice ruled Monday that Britain retains the right to reverse its decision to leave the European Union. The ECJ ruling comes as British Prime Minister Theresa May delayed a House of Commons vote that had been set for Tuesday on whether to approve or reject the Brexit deal. Jamie Detmer in London tells me about reaction in the parliamentary chamber to May's decision to postpone the vote.
Up in the air. The Prime Minister, at a very late stage, decided to delay, to postpone what is called the meaningful vote, the vote on her Brexit deal, on the withdrawal agreement. It was announced this morning, even though it was announced about an hour after she had actually insisted the vote would go ahead. And the reason she's pulled it is that she was facing a huge defeat in the House of Commons. She probably would have only got the backing of about 185 lawmakers compared to 408 who would have voted against, including 100 of her own lawmakers. And if she had faced that defeat, it is highly unlikely that she could have continued as Prime Minister. So her plan is to go back to Brussels to try to reopen negotiations on one or two aspects of the deal. Brussels is reluctant and is as exasperated as many lawmakers in the House of Commons today. They are saying they won't reopen negotiations. The threat is if they try to reopen negotiations to persuade other national leaders in Europe to agree to do that, then the whole deal would have to be renegotiated, including parts of that deal that Britain won't like if they are, you know, either withdrawn or added to by the other European nations. So we're in uncharted territory. It is totally unpredictable where this is going. Quite understandably, that is reflected in the markets today. The pound has dropped already by 1.5%. It's down to 1.25 against the dollar.
Are there tactics, perhaps parliamentary tactics, underway to call a halt to this debate, or even to have a vote of confidence in Prime Minister May?
Oh, there are a variety of parliamentary procedural tactical things being discussed, including by the House Speaker John Bercow, who indicated his frustration with this decision to postpone the vote after 3 days of debate, and has raised some procedural problems for the government in being able to even delay the vote, although it will go ahead. He described the decision to postpone the vote as deeply discourteous. Now, this government has already been found in contempt of Parliament. That happened the other week, the first time in 700 years. There is talk among the opposition leaders, mainly Labour and the Scottish Nationalists, to either table a motion of no confidence in the government or a vote of censure against the Prime Minister herself. So we, again, as I said, are in very unpredictable waters. It seems increasingly that the Prime Minister is really hanging on by her nails. Even loyalist MPs, members of Parliament in her own party, were stunned by this decision to postpone the vote, although there is some relief amongst them as well, the loyalists, because at least she lives to fight another day. But how many days she can fight for is unclear.
I've seen in watching this debate concerns regarding Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that?
Well, there are three or four objections to this deal, and one of the key ones is that Northern Ireland will be treated differently under the deal compared to the rest of the United Kingdom. And the reason for that is to avoid what's called a hard border between the Republic of Ireland, which of course is a member of the EU and will remain in the EU, and Northern Ireland. And the fear amongst Unionist MPs, that the MPs from Northern Ireland and amongst a swathe of lawmakers on the Conservative Party, is that this will diminish the ties between Belfast, between Northern Ireland and London. So that's one objection. The unionist MPs are crucial for this government. May is the head of a minority government. She relies on 10 unionist lawmakers to have a majority in the House of Commons and to pass legislation. They are absolutely against this deal, and they're threatened to withdraw all their support from the government for other business as well.
Jamie Detmer reporting from London. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. President Donald Trump downplays payments to women who allegedly had affairs with him. More than 150 nations adopt the United Nations Migration Pact. The Japanese economy experiences the worst downturn in 4 years, and Nissan Motor and its former chairman are indicted. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
An international group of scientists has identified a new giant plant-eating dinosaur species in South Africa. The team's research and findings are detailed in a study published in the journal Current Biology. Called the Ledumahadi Mafubi, which in the South African indigenous language of Sesotho means a giant thunderclap at dawn. The study suggests when it was alive about 200 million years ago, it was the largest land animal. According to the researchers, the dinosaur weighed about 12 metric tons and its height at its hips was about 4 meters, which was about twice the size of a large African elephant. The dinosaur remains that led to this discovery were found near Clarence in South Africa's Free State Province. Study authors say the Ledumahadi Mafubi is a close early relative to sauropod dinosaurs such as the Brontosaurus. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, French President Emmanuel Macron prepares to address the nation in response to the yellow vest protesters who've held massive demonstrations across the country for the past 4 weekends. Markets continue to be roiled by tensions between the two biggest economies, China and the United States, made worse by the December 1st arrest in Canada of the CFO of China's giant telecom Huawei for alleged violation of U.S. sanctions on Iran. According to court documents, 46-year-old Meng Wanzhou is seeking her release on bail, citing, among other things, the state of her health. Another bail hearing was set for Monday. The arrest and U.S. extradition request have angered Beijing. The foreign ministry summoned the U.S. ambassador, Terry Branstad, to lodge a strong protest. Vice Foreign Minister Li Yongcheng said the actions violate the legitimate and justified rights of a Chinese citizen and demanded measures to correct the wrong practices. A China Daily editorial said Huawei is trying to position itself at the forefront of the 5G revolution, and the U.S. wants to reserve that spot for U.S. companies. It described the move targeting Huawei as nasty. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, in an appearance on the CBS program Face the Nation Sunday, said the Meng case is unrelated to the trade dispute.
It's my view that it shouldn't really have much of an impact. I can understand from the Chinese perspective how they would see it that way. This is a criminal justice matter. It is totally separate from anything that I work on or anything that the trade policy people in the administration work on. So for us, it's unrelated. It's criminal justice. We have a lot of very big, very important issues. We've got serious people working on them, and I don't think they'll be affected by this. We have conversations ongoing. We have had conversations ongoing for over a year on these matters. And they will continue. We have phone calls and we'll set up other meetings. There's been a lot going on over the time. I really think with all this talk about a trade war, it's important to pull back for a second and say that trade really has increased very much in the last year. It's not down. It's up. Exports are really up. imports are up, which I'm not as happy about, but imports are up. Trade is up. The United States is very much engaged in trade and doing so very successfully at this time.
Lighthizer also insisted the March 1st deadline to defuse trade tensions with China is a hard deadline. Following an agreement between Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping of China to a 90-day truce. Robert Manning, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, China has so far shown restraint as Trump continues to up the trade pressure over Chinese trade and economic policies.
What I mean by that is you may recall in 2012, when there was antagonism with Japan, they really unleashed anti-Japanese efforts all over the place in terms of consumers boycotting Japanese goods, Japanese companies, and so on. The Chinese have avoided that and been restrained so far because I think there is a desire to try to find a resolution that both sides can live with. This Huawei thing has sparked a lot of really kind of popular nationalism in China. They don't seem to understand the concept of an independent judiciary. And so you have rumors of all sorts of conspiracy theories surrounding it. So I think that's a worry for markets that this thing spins out of control. I think both sides are going to try to contain the damage. You recall we had a similar case against the Chinese state-backed company ZTE, and that was sorted out in discussions between President Xi and President Trump.
Can the March 1st trade deadline be reached, do you think?
Well, I wonder how hard that deadline is. My sense is that the 90 days were really designed to test how serious China is. That is to say, if we don't have all the I's dotted and T's crossed by March 1st, but we've got a lot of progress on some big and difficult structural issues, Chinese subsidies and so coercive tech transfer policies and a whole range of other technology issues, then I think there'll be a willingness to be more flexible. But if it's just a case of more promises by China and not much delivered, then I think it could be a hard deadline.
So the ball's in China's court.
Yes, but I think the U.S. also has to figure out how to take yes for an answer. There's some things that can do immediately, and they say they're going to do. For example, purchasing more U.S. agricultural and other goods. They could sign a contract for long-term liquid natural gas exports. So that would go a long way towards putting a big dent in the deficit that President Trump is so concerned with. Some of the market access issues, President Xi has on several occasions in terms of letting foreign companies own 100% in areas like financial services, health services, insurance. They claim they're moving in that direction, and I think we're going to have to see results to be taken seriously because they've said it before. Another big issue for President Trump is auto tariffs. At one point, there was a Trump tweet that they'd agreed to get rid of them. Again, that would be a long way towards meeting U.S. goals, but we haven't had any confirmation of that.
Robert Manning of the Atlantic Council, he was speaking with Victor Beatty. French President Emmanuel Macron will address the nation Monday in response to the Yellow Vest protesters who've held massive demonstrations across the country for the past 4 weekends. Before the speech Monday evening, Macron plans to meet with union officials, local lawmakers, and business leaders for talks on formulating a response to the sometimes violent protests that have rocked the country during the holiday season. Workers across France Sunday cleaned up the debris from protesters who threw rocks, burned cars, and vandalized businesses through the weekend. International Edition's Laurie London asked Paris-based journalist Catherine Field how bad the situation has been on the ground.
It's been quite bad, to be honest. Over the weekend, there was violence, riots, unrest in at least 7 cities across France. And, of course, the main focus of this was in Paris, where for again a 12-hour period you had riots, you had demonstrations, you had clashes with police, cars being set on fire, barricades being pushed down, and police firing tear gas. So across the country, there were some 1,700 arrests, of those 900 in Paris. So the violence hasn't calmed down. Certainly, we are looking at the possibility of next weekend yet more unrest, simply because this whole movement has just morphed into something bigger than just a demonstration against an increase of taxes on fuels. It's become something more of a general protest about taxation, rising cost of living, and also this idea that the elite of France are just not paying attention to the needs of the working class.
Why so violent, though?
In lots of ways, the violence has been coming from what they call in French the casseurs, the hooligans. These are just the ultra-right and ultra-left agitators who have mixed in with these protesters. When I was out on the Champs-Élysées with the protesters, you talk to the everyday protesters, some who'd come in from the countryside, and they were really nice, very clear. They said, no, they've had enough. They were living on day to day, from one more euro each day, not knowing how they were going to get to the end of the month. But then you saw some of these hooligans that had come in, had infiltrated, and that's where you get these big scenes of cars burning, rocks being thrown at the police, and the police responding by firing tear gas.
Well, I understand French President Emmanuel Macron is planning on addressing the nation about this Monday. What do you think he's going to say to calm this thing down?
It's really hard to say what he can do. He has already said before that he will not reinstate any of the tax cuts that he's introduced. He said that he will not let the budget deficit grow anymore. He said that the country has to be on more of a positive economic and ecological footing. So what he can do is really hard to say. He's going to be having meetings early Monday with various political opponents, with trade unions, to see what he can come up with. But really, now the momentum is with the protests. Emmanuel Macron hasn't been seen in public now for several weeks. He's got now this aura about him of being arrogant, of being aloof, out of touch, and being the president of a country that's in the middle of a social and economic catastrophe. So it's going to be really hard. He's going to have to pull something very big out of the hat.
Here in the United States, the U.S. president has weighed in over the weekend about the situation with some interesting tweets, and France's foreign minister apparently telling him to butt out. It's not really clear what the president meant, President Trump tweeting about Paris Agreement not working out well and that people there are chanting, "We want Trump." In response, France's foreign minister Sunday telling Mr. Trump to basically not interfere in French politics, that we don't do that to American politics. What do you know about that?
Well, what I can tell you is that I was at the Champs-Élysées around the Arc de Triomphe for many hours during the protests on Saturday, and I did not hear one person say, "We want Donald Trump." In fact, I didn't even hear anyone talk about Donald Trump. The question of Donald Trump saying that this demonstration was all about the Paris Climate Agreement, it has nothing to do with the Paris Climate Agreement. It's actually a demonstration of people talking about wanting their dignity, being able to live on money that they earn and having respect for that. So I don't know where that came from. But certainly the fact that the French foreign minister went on national radio here in France, first thing, and said to Donald Trump, "Leave our nation be," was a very clear sign that France may be having its own problems, but it does not need a U.S. president who is seen as a very divisive character. It does not need the U.S. president coming in and claiming that on the streets of Paris, people are crying out to have Donald Trump and his populist message being the way forward for this country.
Journalist Catherine Field in Paris. She was speaking with International Edition's Lori London. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Editorial cartoons, also known as political cartoons, have been around as long as there's been political discourse and dissent. In the U.S., they're a vibrant part of American culture and history, and no matter how controversial, are protected as free speech under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The late Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Doug Marlette described them as the acid test of the First Amendment. VOA's Julie Tabo spoke with an American Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist about the current state of cartooning in the U.S. and overseas.
Matt Worker draws cartoons for a living. He's a staff cartoonist for Politico, an American political journalism outlet just outside Washington.
We're a strange mix of things in that we are making serious commentary on serious topics, but we're doing it not so seriously, and we get to draw our opinions with silly pictures.
The Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist says the main advantage of a political cartoon is being able to communicate an opinion very quickly.
I can draw a picture and put in a little word bubble, and you can read it in about 4 seconds, and you get it. It has to hit you in the face kind of hard and fast, and you know it when you've been hit.
In this cartoon, for example, Worker was inspired by an iconic image by American artist Norman Rockwell, reflecting a traditional scene of American culture. The cartoonist says over the years, his craft has evolved.
When I started 40 years ago doing cartoons, an editorial cartoon was a black and white single panel cartoon in a newspaper. And now cartoons can be color, they can be animated, they can be graphic novels that are political.
Like this 2018 Pulitzer Prize-winning work by journalist Jake Halper and illustrator Michael Sloan, currently on display at the museum in Washington. The series tells the story of two Syrian families' harrowing journey from their homeland to the U.S., where they settled as refugees in 2016. Patty Rule is vice president of exhibits at the museum.
Since the beginning of this country, editorial cartoons have been framing issues and framing debate from, you know, Ben Franklin, the Live Free or Die, the segmented snake that rallied the 13 colonies together. So it's always been a part of this country and the world's way of freely expressing ideas and debate.
But free expression sometimes comes at a heavy price. In 2015, Islamic terrorists attacked the offices of Charlie Hebdo, a French satirical magazine, after it published unflattering cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. 12 people were killed in the attack, including several prominent cartoonists.
And within their culture, they're certainly entitled to be offended, but they're not entitled to decide that they're going to go to Paris and kill the people that created that cartoon. Many cartoonists have had to flee their countries because they were brave enough to take on regimes or political figures.
Worker hopes that in these troubled times, people will appreciate cartoons for what they are.
I think the good kind of political cartooning is something that slips in a really good political point with a certain amount of good humor and wit that people will process, and hopefully it won't make them angry, but will make them think.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
Thank you very much, Julie, and that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.